So I think it's all great stuff, interviewing some interesting women, a woman from Belgium, a Flemish woman from the islands, refugee, and that's what she's working on is climate refugees. Short interview. Got a her commentary is particularly long as well. Some announcements about some events around town, cultural and otherwise. It's still kind of a holiday weekend. I guess a lot of people made the four-day bridge and are worn out from partying. I'm not sure. Recovering. Okay. What I was going to play was this thing I was talking about last week. It's an anniversary of the Greensboro trial, where some KK and Nazis got together and attacked a very radical group of mixed race people in Greensboro, South Carolina, quite a few years ago. Flint Taylor was a lawyer on that case, and he's still in the activist lawyer community up in Chicagoland at the People's Law Center. Great guy. He has a commentary up at Black Agenda Report about the Greensboro. So in lieu of playing that interview on Law and Disorder Radio, which I commend to your attention as well, you can read his text. I don't know whether he had written that before they had contacted him for the interview. I think maybe the article came out of the idea of the focus on the anniversary. Anyway, without further ado, here's Mumia, then Amy Goodman with her Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, and then we'll get into some material about the climate summit, where the fossil and nuclear fuel people were given a very interesting welcome. I commend your attention to that particular program, and well, actually the column from last Breaking the Sound Barrier essay has that in it as well. A little outtake from that, but here's I think a framed off of death row and off of slow death row. He's getting treatment for his chronic ailment, Hep C, I guess it is. Mumia Abu-Jamal. Find these commentaries on prison radio. He's getting a lot more prisoners. It used to be all his commentaries. Now he's posting a lot of other people.
Have black lives ever mattered? An introduction. Does the title of this work seem provocative? If so, then good. That's how it's intended to be. For if the question is provocative, then what of the answer? Is not the answer, no matter how damning, far more provocative? And yet, who dares answer in any way other than the negative? There is an old axiom, especially among journalists and journalism professors, that today's newspapers are the first draft of history. Like most axioms, they hold a kernel of truth, but there is more. Here is another axiom. History is written by the victors. The words that follow on these pages were not written by a victor, but by one who has seen and sensed what was happening on the other side of a prison wall, who seeks to convey those impressions with truth, and who has often done so several times a week. In a sense, the impressions recorded in these pages ahead are a form of history, black history, recorded during a particular passage of time. During this particular period, we experienced the greatest economic disaster since the Great Depression of the 1930s. The cultural dominance of hip-hop, the nation's fever over mass incarceration, the Obama presidency, the spread of the Black Lives Matter movement, and the unexpected onset of the Donald J. Trump era. True history, what Howard Zinn called the people's history, is the one which gives us voices of ordinary people and create, through these words, their ordinary struggles. And yet for blacks, much that never makes it to the newspapers, or if so, only in a distorted form, still leave scars in the mind, evidence of trauma sustained from simply existing as a black person in the United States of America. The pages ahead reflect the people's struggles in the invisible sectors of American society, sectors which, by a terrible necessity, are populated largely by blacks, Latinos, immigrants, the incarcerated, and those with little income. The pages ahead are also, by equal necessity, reflections of insurgent, emergent, radical, and revolutionary aspiration, thinking, and living. For from oppression comes solidarity, resistance, rebellion, and change. National movements like Black Lives Matter are manifestations of such solidarity and resistance and give voice to the eruption of outrage, angst, hopes, and insurgent protest provoked by each new killing. That such a movement was brought into being by three young women of color, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, is telling. For throughout American history, we have seen how the dedicated efforts of women of color have driven resistance networks and liberation movements. These determined sisters have both studied history and altered it, and continue to do so today. You've been listening to the opening words and introduction to the book, Have Black Lives Ever Mattered? This is its author, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I am here not just to read these words, but to thank you for coming to this party, to greet you, all of you, old, young, straight, gay, black, Latino, brown, yellow, of every color, of every character, of every age, of every gender, for daring to join me here tonight, at least in spirit. I thank you. I welcome you. And believe it or not, I love you, each and every one of you, for being part of this day and this movement. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal saying, I love you all. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
We're going to go right to breaking the sound barrier and then carry on. I've got a little troubleshooting to do down here today. Unexpected, and I hope I'm up for it. Again, Mumia, I think, he was framed by some corrupt cops in Philly who were adjudicated later, but I think maybe they took out Faulkner, who was going to squeal on them in the parlance, perhaps. At the same time, so was sort of clever and almost cinematographic, actually. Here's Amy Goodman sort of framing the cop situation, and we'll be getting to a lot of the web-exclusive material that wasn't on the air here at WEFT, and certainly wasn't on the air anywhere else.
Host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Last week in Bonn, Germany, thousands gathered at the heavily secured United Nations Climate Conference, dubbed COP23, a Potemkin village of bureaucrats, politicians, environmentalists, journalists, and local support staff. 60 kilometers away in the 12,000-year-old Hambacher Forest, scores of activists living in tree houses defended the old-growth woodland in an ongoing struggle to save the rare ecosystem from destruction and stop the expansion of Europe's largest open-pit mine, a sprawling hole in the earth where energy company RWE extracts lignite, or brown coal, the dirtiest coal on earth. Hanging over both was the political pall cast by President Donald Trump, who announced on June 1st that he's pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, the global climate change accord negotiated by all the countries of the world.
So whilst the United States might be saying that it's pulling out, it still continues to play a destructive role.
That's Asad Rehman, executive director of the London-based War on Want, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. We were broadcasting from inside COP23. COP stands for Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC.
So Donald Trump, of course, has come here backed by his fossil fuel pals, and he's come here to wreck the climate negotiations.
Big promises were made in Paris in 2015. Each signatory to the Paris Agreement made a voluntary pledge to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions. If pledges are met, the theory goes, then the global temperature rise above pre-industrial levels will be capped at 1.5 or at worst 2 degrees Celsius. That's between 2.7 and 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, avoiding the worst consequences of climate disruption. Rich countries, largely responsible for the world's polluting carbon emissions to date, pledged hundreds of billions of dollars to poorer nations to allow them to recover from climate damage already done and to pursue a renewably powered development path. In response to Trump, U.S. civil society organized the We Are Still In Coalition, with over 2,500 elected officials, state and local governments, CEOs, businesses, universities, faith leaders, and grassroots organizations committing to meeting the Paris Agreement's goals since the Trump administration won't. It's a big coalition, and not without dissension. As California's Democratic Governor Jerry Brown was speaking in Bonn, protesters began chanting, California's fracking spreads pollution, and keep it in the ground. Brown responded, addressing an indigenous activist.
In the ground. I agree with you. In the ground. Let's put you in the ground so we can get on with the show here.
The grim imagery of a white governor threatening to put a Native American in the ground was not missed by anyone. Just 1 year ago, as families gathered in the United States to celebrate Thanksgiving, the holiday predicated on the wholesale whitewashing of the colonial genocide against Native Americans, the indigenous-led resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, known as DAPL, on Standing Rock Sioux tribal territory in North Dakota, was being subjected to increasingly intense state violence. Police and National Guard unleashed so-called less-than-lethal armaments with rubber-coated steel ball bullets, tear gas, pepper spray, LRAD sound cannons, and water cannons fired on crowds in sub-zero temperatures. The Standing Rock Sioux call the pipeline the Black Snake, carrying fracked petroleum from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota through South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois for transfer to another pipeline to carry it to the Gulf Coast. The Black Snake's arrival in Lakota territory has long been prophesied. Last Thursday, as COP23 was wrapping up, a massive leak in the Keystone Pipeline was discovered in South Dakota. At least 210,000 gallons of oil leaked from the pipeline, just as TransCanada, the pipeline's owner, was seeking final permission from Nebraska's Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, to build its Keystone XL, the KXL pipeline. Despite the leak, the PUC granted the permit for the controversial KXL to carry toxic tar sands oil from Canada to the hurricane-battered U.S. Gulf Coast for refining. President Obama, after years of resistance, finally killed the pipeline. Trump, as soon as he took office, boastfully greenlit both the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipeline. Back in the Hambacher Forest in Germany, activists are bracing for RWE and German police to raid their treehouse villages, arrest them all, and clear-cut the remaining 10% of the ancient forest.
The problem is the system we live in. So if it's legal for a company to destruct our whole planet, that means that it's time to also resist against state power.
That's a forest defender named Indigo. Commenting on the nearby COP23, she added,
it's time that we take responsibility for our own lives and that we create a world which gives us the power to act instead of hoping that other people will solve problems.
The day before the climate summit opened, 4,500 people marched into the open pit and halted mining for the day. Nearby in the remaining occupied forest, a banner was strung between two ancient oaks. It proclaimed, "Respect existence or expect resistance." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, still kind of frenzied down here. Let's see. Mark Weisbrot has a piece up on Black Agenda Report too, I noticed, as well as that Flint Taylor article about the anniversary of the Greensboro massacre. Chicago lawyer now, originally from out in the Carolinas, I guess. Trump doubles down on sanctions and regime change for Venezuela, dated the 22nd, so recent article. Something. Okay, that's a solution indeed. The new chairman of the FCC was a top lawyer at Verizon. Now he's calling to vote to kill net neutrality. It's coming rather fast. There is a comment period, but because he's out of Verizon, there's December 7th. I guess that's a Thursday. Coming up, time to plan, I guess. Demos around the country at the Verizon outfits. And I guess there must be one in town here. Speaking of Native Americans, this month is actually Native American Heritage Month, surprisingly. Haven't heard much about it. Hear a lot of the local media complaining about the Big Ten networks cutting chief imagery out of its football coverage. Is there a game? I guess the last one, right? I don't know what time it is. Over at Spurlock Museum, there is a event from, it's a drop-in event, but you can take home a Blackfoot Quill Works style bracelet, it says. So I guess they have someone who'll help you do that. 1 to 3:30 at Spurlock. That's just east of the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. If you haven't been on the campus for a while, it's not a lot of traffic, so maybe the game's up in Chicago. Let me see if that does it. And, that didn't do it. Oh, there's some more cables to snug, though. Well, let's get to some coverage. This is a short interview that Amy Goodman did in Bonn, former capital of Germany. There's so much going on, it's hard to stay to this, but maybe I'll have some time at the end to talk about Victor's justice in the Balkans, among other things. That's the way I see it anyway. The longer piece I'll save to the second hour, and this is this British guy, Anderson. There's a report out about the dangers of natural gas. It's referred to in this, but not elaborated on at length, at least, well, when I was previewing it. I guess I didn't hear it. Maybe that's me. And this is a refugee, climate refugee herself, talking about now being in charge of a group that's working with climate refugees. Amy Goodman from last week at the climate summit, if you will.
Respect existence or expect resistance. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Last week in Bonn, Germany, thousands gathered at the heavily secured United Nations Climate Conference, dubbed COP23, a Potemkin village of bureaucrats, politicians, environmentalists, journalists, and local support staff. 60 kilometers away in the 12,000-year-old Hambacher Forest, scores of activists living in tree houses defended the old-growth woodland in an ongoing struggle to save the rare ecosystem from destruction and stop the expansion of Europe's largest open-pit mine, a sprawling hole in the earth where energy company RWE extracts lignite, or brown coal, the dirtiest coal on earth. Hanging over both was the political pall cast by President Donald Trump, who announced on June 1st that he's pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, the global climate change accord negotiated by all the countries of the world.
So whilst the United States might be saying that it's pulling out, it still continues to play a destructive role.
That's Asad Rehman, executive director of the London-based War on Wants, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. We were broadcasting from inside COP23. COP stands for Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC.
So Donald Trump, of course, has come here backed by his fossil fuel pals, and he's come here to wreck the climate negotiations.
Big promises were made in Paris in 2015. Each signatory to the Paris Agreement made a voluntary pledge to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions. If pledges are met, the theory goes, then the global temperature rise above pre-industrial levels will be capped at 1.5 or at worst 2 degrees Celsius. That's between 2.7 and 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, avoiding the worst consequences of climate disruption. Rich countries, largely responsible for the world's polluting carbon emissions to date, pledged hundreds of billions of dollars to poorer nations to allow them to recover from climate damage already done and to pursue a renewably powered development path. In response to Trump, U.S. civil society organized the We Are Still In Coalition, with over 2,500 elected officials, state and local governments, CEOs, businesses, universities, faith leaders, and grassroots organizations committing to meeting the Paris Agreement's goals since the Trump administration won't. It's a big coalition, and not without dissension. As California's Democratic Governor Jerry Brown was speaking in Bonn, protesters began chanting, California's fracking spreads pollution, and keep it in the ground. Brown responded, addressing an indigenous activist.
In the ground. I agree with you. In the ground. Let's put you in the ground so we can get on with the show here.
The grim imagery of a white governor threatening to put a Native American in the ground was not missed by anyone. Just 1 year ago, as families gathered in the United States to celebrate Thanksgiving, the holiday predicated on the wholesale whitewashing of the colonial genocide against Native Americans, the indigenous-led resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline, known as DAPL, on Standing Rock Sioux tribal territory in North Dakota, was being subjected to increasingly intense state violence. Police and National Guard unleashed so-called less-than-lethal armaments with rubber-coated steel ball bullets, tear gas, pepper spray, LRAD sound cannons, and water cannons fired on crowds in sub-zero temperatures. The Standing Rock Sioux call the pipeline the Black Snake, carrying fracked petroleum from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota through South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois for transfer to another pipeline to carry it to the Gulf Coast. The Black Snake's arrival in Lakota territory has long been prophesied. Last Thursday, as COP23 was wrapping up, a massive leak in the Keystone Pipeline was discovered in South Dakota. At least 210,000 gallons of oil leaked from the pipeline, just as TransCanada, the pipeline's owner, was seeking final permission from Nebraska's Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, to build its Keystone XL, the KXL pipeline. Despite the leak, the PUC granted the permit for the controversial KXL to carry toxic tar sands oil from Canada to the hurricane-battered U.S. Gulf Coast for refining. President Obama, after years of resistance, finally killed the pipeline. Trump, as soon as he took office, boastfully greenlit both the Keystone XL and the Dakota Access Pipeline. Back in the Hambacher Forest in Germany, activists are bracing for RWE and German police to raid their treehouse villages, arrest them all, and clear-cut the remaining 10% of the ancient forest.
The problem is the system we live in. So if it's legal for a company to destruct our whole planet, that means that it's time to also resist against state power.
That's a forest defender named Indigo. Commenting on the nearby COP23, she added,
it's time that we take responsibility for our own lives and that we create a world which gives us the power to act instead of hoping that other people will solve problems.
The day before the climate summit opened, 4,500 people marched into the open pit and halted mining for the day. Nearby in the remaining occupied forest, a banner was strung between two ancient oaks. It proclaimed, "Respect existence or expect resistance." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And I'm still out in the outer planetary realm. We're trying to get the next program up, and it's problematic today. So we're going to carry on with this review of the web exclusive sections from Democracy Now. Again, Pacifica was the only real U.S. Outfit that was there covering it, and I already dissed the BBC for their lack of attention. Maybe they did a major feature. I didn't hear it, but I did not hear it much in the headlines and in the reviews that they do casually. Okay. Which one's next? Oh, yes, the lovely weather woman from Flemish land. Sounds with Peters with a double E. It's pretty clear that she's not Wallonie, as the French are called it, or the region is. I think it's the major region in Belgium. But here's Amy again. And how are we doing count-wise? Well, we're actually running a little late.
Now.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany. Well, this year, climate-related hurricanes have devastated parts of the United States, from Houston to Florida to Puerto Rico. You've got the wildfires in California. But even as there's been wall-to-wall coverage of the flooding, the storms, the fires, weather presenters, TV meteorologists in the United States still rarely utter the words. They say severe weather. They say extreme weather. But what about another two words, climate change? Meanwhile, right-wing news outlets like Breitbart Media are actively trying to spread propaganda about how the Earth is not warming but cooling. Let's turn to a clip of Weather Channel meteorologist Kate Parker slamming Breitbart for featuring one of her videos alongside an article filled with misinformation about climate change.
So last week, Breitbart.com published an article claiming that global warming was nothing but a scare and global temperatures were actually falling. Problem is, they used a completely unrelated video about La Nina with my face in it to attempt to back their point. Now, what's worse is that the U.S. Committee on Space Science and Technology actually tweeted it out. Here's the thing. Science doesn't care about your opinion. Cherry picking and twisting the facts will not change the future, nor the fact, note fact, not opinion, that the Earth is warming.
The Earth is warming, says Weather Channel meteorologist Kate Parker. Well, we're joined now by another weather presenter who never hesitates to use the word climate change. Jill Peters is a weather presenter in Belgium. She's the founder also of a group called Climate Without Borders, a group that educates weather presenters worldwide about how to report on both the weather and climate change. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Hi, Amy.
So it's great to have you with us, Jill. I mean, in the United States, It is so rare to hear from the meteorologists on television the words climate change, no matter if they're doing 24-hour-a-day coverage of the hurricanes, of the fires, of the very severe weather events that we're experiencing.
Well, it's not only in the USA that it's challenging to get climate change in the weather reports. There are a lot of countries who are still struggling to get climate change in their weather reports. But you see more and more tendency to that weather presenters do try to link extreme weather events to the changing climate. And we now have this new science, it's the attribution science, which support us. But one of the main things Climate Without Borders is working on is that weather presenters all over the world are not only looking pretty and being popular, they also are the bridge between the science and they have an enormous reach towards the citizens. And they are trusted by the citizens, and that trust, they can use it on other platforms, like on Twitter and Instagram. Some of my colleagues, for example, in Nepal, he talks about climate on radio. My colleague from Ghana, she made a calendar, which she distributed in Ghana. That's another way to communicate on climate.
Did you always talk about climate change?
No. Well, I started talking about climate change, I think, about 10 years ago, but even more. But before that, I wasn't aware, really, about the changing climate. Me, as a meteorologist, I can explain every thunderstorm in a meteorological way. But you have to zoom out in time, you have to zoom out in space to understand the whole picture. And that's something we're bringing with Climate Without Borders to our meteorologists, that they don't have to explain each meteorological event in a meteorological way. They have to learn to zoom out. And once they get this, they start communicating.
I mean,
about
you
climate.
See the meteorologists in every outfit possible, whether they're covering the fires or they're standing with their boots in the
yeah.
rain, and it's miserable. You know, freezing, it's boiling, whatever. I see it as like standing at an intersection where there's no traffic light, and they stand there, and every few hours they describe a horrible car crash and the people who died or the people who got sick, and then they wait there, and then the networks go to them when there's another car crash a few hours later. But they never once say, why don't they get a traffic light that might solve this problem? And that's beginning the explanation of climate change.
Yeah, well, we should. We should all integrate at that moment, like, look, this is happening here right now, and everybody is affected, especially the less stronger people in society. They are hit much harder than other people. For example, the hurricane in Puerto Rico. When it hit Puerto Rico, even before it hit Puerto Rico, the highest educated people left the island. After the hurricane hit Puerto Rico, the middle class could leave the island, but the people who weren't able to leave the island are still stuck there. So there you see the difference in education, in the social context where you live in. And the weather presenters are, you're so right, they are at the barricades of the changing climate. And they should really, yeah, talk more about the changing climate.
So talk about Climate Without Borders, this mm-hmm. group you started.
Well, it started after the Paris Agreement. I was very inspired by the Paris Agreement, and there is this Article 12 who states that all parties shall invest in climate awareness and good climate education. And especially in these times of fake news and alternative facts, it's very important to have a trusted source. And most of the people worldwide trust their weather presenter. And weather presenters have the knowledge to communicate about uncertainties. We're used to doing that. So it's not a huge step to integrate climate communication. And Climate Without Borders now has a network of almost 140 weather presenters of 110 countries. And we exchange information on extreme weather, on new climate studies, on best practices. And we inspire each other and we support each other. And we became one big family, global family. And
Article 12 says you must educate people about climate change.
Yes, yes. Article 12 of the Paris Agreement explicitly states that all parties shall invest in climate education.
One of your members is from Dominica?
Yes, she is.
They dealt with a severe hurricane. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah. Before the hurricane hit, Dominica, our colleague Farah, she's called, she kept us on top of this information all of the time. So we all knew exactly what could happen there. And the last message she sent into our group was a radar picture of this hurricane almost hitting her island. And then she said, pray for us, with the praying hands. And then for about a week, we did not hear anything. And can you imagine a community of almost 140 friends? Everybody was so worried about her, because that was the last message we had. And then 7 days later, we got a message, I am still alive. I still get goosebumps, look. I am still alive, and we communicated with the whole community so much about this event, and she's still trying to recover. We invited her here at a COP, but just when she wanted to step on the airplane, she was obliged. She could not come because of the government wanted all people working on meteorological to stay at their island.
Do you have American weather presenters, meteorologists,
yes,
as part of your team? You said there's a woman from Puerto Rico in your team.
There is, yeah. Ada Monzon from Puerto Rico is on our network, but we also have some people from Florida, Miami. We have from New York. We have...
Do they talk about the difficulty, why it is? We're not talking Fox here. We're not talking Breitbart. Mm-hmm. We're talking CNN and MSNBC. Mm-hmm. Almost never does a meteorologist say those words, climate change. Do they talk about why that is? What are the pressures?
Yeah, well, you do have Climate Central in the USA, and Climate Central produces very good graphics, very good content to support weather presenters who do want to communicate on climate. And in January, this coming January, there will be the AMS, the American Meteorological Society, gathering with all weather presenters and all weather and science scientists. And we will organize a session over there with Climate Without Borders, but especially with Climate Central, to get these American weather presenters engaged in climate communication. But there's a long way. They have to learn how to zoom out of their own weather in their own channel. They have to learn how to zoom out, and we can support them in this.
President Trump says he's pulling the U.S. out of the climate accord, the Paris Climate Accord. What does that mean to you?
Well, in fact, the day he was elected last year, I was also at a COP in Marrakesh. Ever since, I have never been communicating about the Paris Agreement as much as I did before. Because now, because of his election and of his pulling out, wanting to pull out, I had the opportunity to talk to each and everyone to say, look, this is what the Paris Agreement stands for. It's the first time in history that I have been frequently talking about this Paris Agreement. Before, I couldn't, because people thought, okay, this boring agreement and blah, blah, blah. And people felt offended in my country, like, you have this president who doesn't even believe in climate change, but he has a responsibility. I say, okay, if you think that your president has a responsibility, that means that human people impact the climate. So you agree on that? And then they say, yes, of course. So it's the first time in my country and a lot of European countries that people spoke out and spoke up and said, yeah, you're right. Presidents and prime ministers, everybody should care and take action.
So, Jill Peters, you've danced for climate change. You've sang for climate. Can you talk about what you've done?
Sorry?
You've danced. You've sang for climate change.
Oh, what have I done? I danced for climate. I sang for the climate.
On the show?
On your TV broadcast? It was we danced for the climate with about 10,000 people on the beach in Belgium. We also had the climate song, great climate song. Google it, climate song. It's a lovely, it's a protest song. We should all know that song. I even posed naked on a cover of a magazine covered with paint because I wanted to attract attention on climate. And they were like, okay, Jill Peters, she's always very serious. And now she's naked, covered with paint, of course. And they were like, okay, why? Okay, is it that serious? I also made a child program. I wrote books.
And finally, as a model for U.S. meteorologists, TV presenters, can you say how you incorporate climate change into just a weather report? What do you say?
Oh, it's very easy. One of the things I usually do on an almost daily basis is showing the wind energy and the solar energy from my region. Like, after a sunny day, I show them the solar energy, and I say, look, about 500,000 families could profit from solar energy today. It's very simple because it's a positive story. We do have the solutions, but we only have to take action. It's getting pretty urgent.
In fact, you say bring a meteorologist next time to the UN Climate
All
Summit.
All parties should, they shall. I hope they bring their weather presenter. Yeah.
Jill Peters, weather presenter in Belgium, founder of Climate Without Borders. About 140 meteorologists on television and radio are part of this organization. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. This is part two of our conversation with the climate scientist Kevin Anderson. A major new study says European governments have drastically underestimated the methane emissions from gas. The report finds European Union nations can burn gas and other fossil fuels at the current rate for only 9 more years before these countries will have exhausted their share of the Earth's remaining carbon budget necessary to keep temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, we're joined now by the co-author of the report. He's one of the world's leading climate scientists. He traveled to the Bonn summit by train from England because he refuses to fly because of its massive carbon footprint. Kevin Anderson is deputy director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester in Britain, co-author of the report entitled, Can the Climate Afford Europe's Gas Addiction? Kevin Anderson, thanks for staying with us for part two of this conversation. Well, can the planet afford this?
Well, certainly not. If we are to deliver on our 2°C climate change commitment, then the EU's plans and policies for the development of a much larger gas network are completely incompatible with the EU's fair contribution to the Paris Agreement. So all of the proposals and development we're seeing with new liquefied natural gas LNG terminals, the proposals for these new pipelines that are coming from Azerbaijan and from other parts of the world, these are completely incompatible with Paris, and they are locking us into an ongoing high-carbon future.
Can you just explain for a minute, for lay people, I mean, part of why I think, especially in the United States, with oil companies and others funding what many call not think tanks, but stink tanks, that they don't even understand what most people don't understand what the Paris Climate Accord is. And they thought there was actually dissent saying, was it meaningless? What is it? What is Trump threatening to pull the U.S. out of?
The principal part, and certainly the part I focus on, but the principal part in terms of the temperature goals. In other words, we want to hold the global average temperature to a rise of no more than 2 degrees C from the pre-industrial period, and that's basically been brought about by the burning of fossil fuels and some emissions from agriculture. And 2 degrees centigrade or 3.6 Fahrenheit is seen to relate to the set of climate impacts that we would see around the world that people have judged collectively would be dangerous. Indeed, many parts of the world now say they would be extremely dangerous, which is why the Paris Agreement also included, at the behest of some of the poorer, more vulnerable parts of the world, a 1.5 degrees C goal as well. So these temperatures are, although they don't sound too bad in a cold day in Manchester or in Uppsala, you think 2 degrees doesn't sound too bad. They have massive regional repercussions. They have big effects on extreme weather conditions, whether that's droughts or whether that's floods or heat waves. So the 2 degrees C average is a very significant shift. It's worth bearing in mind that throughout the whole of human period on this planet, so 200 to 300,000 years, we've only ever lived through about 1 degree variation. We are now at a variation away from the norm that we've never seen as humans on this planet, and it's getting higher every single year. Hmm.
So you have Syria just signed on to the Paris Climate Accord, as did Nicaragua. Now, Nicaragua had objected to it because they said it just wasn't strong enough. You also had fierce criticisms of it. So what do you think actually needs to happen now? You have the Paris Climate Accord. Where do you think the world needs to go?
The science is fairly clear on this. The Paris Climate Accord has these temperature, I would call them obligations, not targets. They're duties or obligations. We have to achieve them, not try to achieve them. We have to achieve them, particularly the 2 degrees C one. And the science is very clear that to deliver on that, we only have a certain amount of carbon dioxide that we can put into the atmosphere. Now, that's like having a cake of carbon dioxide, if you like. And the fair thing then is, how do you divide that cake up between the world's nations? That's, of course, where you get lots of horseplay, and everyone thinks that we should have a bigger chunk, bigger slice than really we should have, and others will have to compensate for that. Every country thinks that. The US, the UK, the rest of the EU, you know, every country in the world says we want a larger slice than we can really have. But the problem with that is when you add all those slices together, it's much bigger than the cake. And so this is what we have here. You add up all of the commitments that every country has made, and it's probably somewhere between 3 and 4 degrees C of warming, which would be utterly devastating. at a global level. So we have this 2°C carbon cake, and if we were to really resolve that properly, we need to divide it up in a fair fashion. And at the moment, no country really is trying to do that. And the EU, who of course was very significantly involved in the Paris Agreement, and been based in the EU, has sort of tried to demonstrate that it's one of the leading parts of the world, and perhaps the leading part of the world, in delivering on Paris. And yet, when you look internally what it's planning to do, it's going to use public money, billions of euros of public money, to subsidise fossil fuel development that will lock the EU into ongoing use of very high carbon gas for the next 30 or 40 years. It will breach its commitments, its fair commitments under the Paris Agreement. And when we've spoken to some of the advisors to commissioners in the European Commission, they admit this privately, but they're reluctant to say it open and publicly. So they see these investments are a problem from a climate point of view, but they see them as necessary from other sort of political requirements of the EU. So I think there's this ongoing balance between what our political and economic goals are and what our climate change and our moral goals are to future generations and poor people elsewhere.
And what about the United States? So that wasn't the subject of this particular study.
No, it wasn't, no. Well, it wasn't the subject of this study, but the United States is interesting because the United States has had quite a big shift towards gas production, from shale gas in particular. And as a result, partly as a result of that, its emissions have looked like they've sort of stabilised and come down a little bit, except for, of course, it's exporting quite a lot of the coal that it would otherwise have burnt. So, you know, it doesn't mean necessarily that that's a good thing. If the US transitions to gas but then exports its coal, that is also a problem. The other drawback, of course, is the US is producing so much gas now, it is already building terminals to export that gas to other parts of the world. And this is liquefied natural gas. And now, gas is very bad when you burn it. You get lots of carbon dioxide. But liquefied natural gas also has a lot of additional carbon dioxide emissions from the process of doing that, but also methane emissions and the leaks that come from the LNG process itself.
Now, LNG, liquefied natural gas,
yeah.
This constant term, natural gas, it was like clean coal. Do you refer to natural gas?
Well, gas, natural gas, shale gas, it's all basically the same. It's all, with a very few differences, it's all basically methane. And methane is the chemical constituents of methane are carbon and hydrogen. And if you had a kilogram or if you had a pound of methane, 75% of that pound or that kilogram would be carbon. So although people often refer to it as a bridging fuel, a transition fuel, sometimes even people completely mistakenly call it a low carbon fuel, it is a very high carbon energy source. It's not quite as bad as coal, but it's still very high carbon and completely incompatible with the Paris Agreement.
When you watch protests like, well, I mean, here, the protests against the coal, the largest open pit coal mine in Europe, in the United States, for example, the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, thousands of Native Americans from Latin America, the United States First Nations from Canada converging in North Dakota, saying no to taking this back and fracked oil from North Dakota through South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, and then hooking up with a pipeline to the Gulf of Mexico. What were your thoughts about it? I mean, yes, you're a scientist, but how effective do you think this is? And what is this gas, what is this oil being used for?
It's hard to judge exactly how effective it is, but I think it is absolutely pivotal in that it brings attention to these issues that we would not otherwise be fully aware of. And it's the same, you see these debates in Germany now around the coal mines, you see the debates in the UK around the shale gas, where we see what people often refer to as civil disobedience. Now, I don't want to, as an academic, say civil disobedience is something we should all aspire to, but I think it's a choice here of civil disobedience. We have the people saying it is incorrect, inappropriate, to actually dig out and burn dirty brown coal like an advanced country as Germany is doing now with its lignite. And so that you could call
the
civil
brown
disobedience.
Coal, this dirty coal.
But even if it's not brown coal, but digging out coal in a wealthy country like Germany and using that to power its energy system is inappropriate. And so people are using civil disobedience to try to bring attention to that and to try and stop it. But I would argue actually digging it out of the ground is also civil disobedience, because that is completely counter to what we've signed up in Paris. So you have this choice between two forms of civil disobedience, one that is sanctioned by government and one that's where people stand up for a moral framework. And I think it's up to us, as the rest of us as citizens, to judge which of those forms of civil disobedience is inappropriate. Remember, the ones that are standing up against the lignite mines are standing up for our children's future and for poor people elsewhere to live more prosperous lives.
We're talking to one of the leading climate scientists in the world, Kevin Anderson, who took a train from Britain to Germany for this climate summit. You have warned about what you call a shameful litany of technocratic scams. You said offsetting is paying a poor person to diet for us. Explain what you mean. Even offsetting is just a technical term.
Okay. Well, just to put this in some sort of context, the first IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, came out in 1990.
That's the IPCC is the Nobel Prize winning, Peace Prize winning group of scientists.
Group of scientists. So it's basically all of the world's sciences brought together and assimilated in really very detailed, carefully produced reports. The first one came out in 1990, 2 years before the Rio Earth Summit, which was a quarter of a century ago. Since then, we've known everything we need to know about climate change to do something about it. And yet now in 2017, emissions are 60% higher and going up again by another 2% this year. So when I say this litany of scams, during that period, during that 27 years, there is nothing we have put in place that's made any absolute meaningful difference to our emissions. Our emissions have just got higher every single year. And those scams include one of the ones that also, in this case, has been promoted by the UNFCCC, who sort of oversee all of these COP events and much of the work on climate change, and do a lot of really very excellent work. But in overseeing COP, they've offered this offsetting scheme. So as you fly here with your standard class or your business class or first class, you can offset just for a few cents, basically, a few dollars, all of your emissions, apparently. And offsetting means that we will pay someone else to maybe develop some renewable power or whatever that might be somewhere else in the world. And that allows us to carry on with our lives as we're doing today. But as we carry on with our lives today, that means we're sending a signal to the airports to expand. Almost every airport in the world is expanding to buy more planes. We are buying more and more planes. So we are locking in a high carbon infrastructure. Meanwhile, other parts of the world are perhaps developing a renewable energy infrastructure, which is a good thing, good for development. But in doing that, that will also give them advertisers access to people locally there, who they will develop slightly faster, and their carbon emissions will no doubt go up in the short term. That's not a bad thing, but it is not an offset. So the combination of offsetting means overall that our emissions get higher, not lower. But it may be that from a development point of view, some of the money is spent on good things. But let's not pretend in any way that an offset compensates for the emissions that we definitely put in the atmosphere when we burn fossil fuels, whether that's traveling here or we're heating our homes and so forth.
Well, let's talk more about lifestyle, because this is very important to you. I watched you at several of the sessions here. You've taken a train here. When we last saw you a few COPs ago, the Conference of Parties, you also had refused to take a plane. You said you got a lot out of the many, 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 many hours on the train. I think it was in Poland that we saw you.
Yeah, it was, yes. Yeah.
How long did that take?
Oh, I can't remember. It must have been 2 or 3 days. But I've also been to China and to Iceland by ship. Yeah, so there are other, I go to other places as well, but it changes how often you go. So it changes how you have to run and structure your life, which is not always easy in a world that is increasingly structured to allow us to do things faster and faster. So you have to sort of almost step back from that and say, well, what am I going to do about my other responsibilities whilst I'm away? How does that affect your friends and family? It's not easy to organize the tickets because the system is not designed for that. So we've designed a whole system really around flying. And actually, interestingly, now I work 50% of my time at Seamus in Uppsala, at Uppsala University.
In Sweden.
And I travel backwards and forwards to the UK. There are no more ferries between Sweden and between Scandinavia and the UK. And there are no more overnight trains because aviation has pushed those out of the market. So it takes me 2 days just to travel from Sweden back to the UK. This is challenging, but it does mean I can get a lot more work done on the train. But I think what's important there is less, as I said before, less my emissions in themselves, but it sends a very strong signal that we can still live good quality lives. You can still become a university professor and not fly. I mean, I haven't flown since 2004, and I've got lots of other colleagues.
You haven't been in a plane since 2004?
2004, yeah. And emissions of the average car being sold. So we have all of these technologies being sold today with no price premium, but we have no courage within our policymakers to push these things hard.
So even the work we do, when we do it, the issue of day and night. Can you talk about when we do our work and the electricity need?
Just in our day-to-day activities, we get up in the morning, we flick the lights on if it's still dark in the winter, we go downstairs, we make our breakfast, we put the toaster on, we're using energy all the time. Now that energy could be used much more efficiently than we use it currently, but also we can be more careful in how we use it. So very commonly, you'll just see, like I saw here on Friday, you'll see just lights are left on. And what has been quite interesting in many parts of Europe, as they've got much more efficient light bulbs, these LED light bulbs, actually the lighting demand has not gone down because people just have more light. lights and leave them on more often because they're more efficient. So the one problem with efficiency in our day-to-day lives is that we cannot use the money we save just on more energy activities. So historically, energy efficiency has never brought emissions down or even energy consumption down. But that's the role of policymakers then, to put policies in to stop this, what we call the rebound effect, which is really important. That if you make things more efficient, people just use the, you know, the spare money from not having to buy as much energy to buy other energy services. And it's therefore the role of government to put policy in to stop that rebound effect. But if we did do that, efficiency could really drive down our emissions.
So Kevin Anderson, you're a leading climate scientist, and I want to ask you about the Trump effect. People talk about it's not only what President Trump is doing in the United States, but the effect, the reverberations of his actions around the world, whether we're talking about the possibility of nuclear war, which will certainly destroy the environment with North Korea or Iran, not clear, or pulling the U.S. out of the U.N. climate accord. But I wanted to ask you about his effect on people's views of science. He has called climate change a hoax. Have you seen a change? I mean, you have me asking, you just heard me asking David Banks, his climate advisor, how he rejects 95% of the world's scientists. Are you seeing a change in the attitude towards scientists and science as a result of the 45th president of the United States?
When it comes to climate change, I think I'm talking from quite a privileged position being in the UK and the EU, where I don't really think Trump's, I mean, to be polite, they're just ramblings about climate change. Trump's ramblings have really had any impact in how we view science, or indeed how the rest of society has viewed the climate change science and research. When I talk to some of my American colleagues, clearly some of them are concerned more about issues of funding. It hasn't changed how they view their own science. And my understanding is actually from quite a lot of some of the polling data in the US is that it hasn't really changed the public's view towards science. What it has done is put some fear into people that are working there about their job security, about their research funds, about whether they can make things publicly accessible, as most scientists want their work to be made publicly available. So people are publishing work but taking the words climate change out of it, using other forms of language.
You're talking about American scientists.
Yeah, this is American in the US, yeah. So I think in the US, from what I understand, it has made some difference to how people have to operate. But you know, the climate change community is reasonably bright and astute. They're pretty well educated. I think they can find ways around Trump's ramblings. But I do think it is a problem from a sort of a funding perspective. We're also fully aware that he will only be there for 4 to 8 years, and that it's very unlikely you get someone else like Trump in following him, at least as effectively a climate denier. But also, of course, it could be that he changes his mind. He changes his mind regularly. People keep trying to predict what he's going to do next, so I think it's foolish. He doesn't know, and nor do we. So he might become in year four, he might become a real climate advocate. Who knows? So I think we have to really get on with our work almost independent of what the wisdom of the U.S. president.
Well, you said, you talked about the Trump effect in another way, that with the U.S. pulling out, this is giving much more power and space to, for example, grassroots activists.
Well, more than grassroots, it's certainly given more to grassroots activists, but I think it's really been quite interesting that you could argue that we had the Paris Agreement, everyone went away, thought we've got this agreement, this piece of paper, somehow as if that solved the problem, which clearly it does not. But by him pulling out, he's brought climate change back to the fore. So you've got a lot of US mayors, and you've got a fairly significant delegation from the US here. I mean, they're not representing the government, but they're representing individual states and cities. And so they're really
engaging. We're still in coalition.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes, we're still in coalition. And it's also brought the Chinese back to the table. Pushing hard at the table. And the French have come back in to discuss these issues. So I think in some respects, what Trump has done has brought Paris, or the issue of climate change, back nearer the higher up the agenda, let's put it that. So I think you could also say that some of his ramblings have had that sort of political benefit, which I thought was not what he wanted. I mean, it's almost backfired.
As we begin to wrap up, you said yesterday at one of the panels, we fear questioning the dominant socioeconomic paradigm. What is that, and what does that lead to?
And this is one of the most challenging issues, I think, in climate change. Because we've chosen to leave it so late, as I said before, we're 27 years after the first IPCC report, our carbon budget is so incredibly small. And the dominant paradigm is that we will see economic growth, better material well-being, for all 7.5 billion people on the planet, not just the poor ones, but all of us, including the very wealthy. That will just go on forever, almost infinite. And that is broadly the framing of the current economic paradigm. The problem is that's completely incompatible with the climate change objectives we have. And if we don't achieve those objectives, then the climate impacts that we will suffer will also make that impossible. So either way, the future will not fit with the current economic paradigm. So we need to be honest about that and start to unpick that and say, well, what else really matters? And we should be really measuring prosperity in relation to the good things in the world, whether that's job security, female literacy, reduced crime. There are a myriad of good things that we can recognize in the world. Let's look at those things and make them good. Now, whether that makes the economic growth better or worse is pretty much an irrelevance. You know, that's a technical issue that a few narrow economists want to think about. But really, let's start to focus on what's important in our lives. And if we did that, I think we could actually reconcile climate change objectives like in the Paris Agreement with a prosperous, low-carbon future for the majority of us around the world. But that will mean in the short term a material consumption hit for those of us who are very high emitters, people like myself, and if you like, the climate glitterati, and the other ones who don't work on climate change who are also in that same sort of category. We will have to take...